Welcome to COPCOM, the Court of Protection and Community Care podcast, hosted by me, Matthew Wyard, from 3PB Barristers. We've got a slight change to the advertised episode of this podcast. We indicated at the last episode it was going to be on closed proceedings, but there have been two very interesting cases that have come out of the COP that people need to know about since then. So we thought rather than waste your time with closed proceedings discussions, we would go straight on to the latest updates from the court. Only two pieces of news this month. Firstly, in relation to myself having become a committee member for COPPA West Midlands, and secondly, the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman being slated. For those of you who haven't seen it yet, there's a report from the 30th of March from the Public Administration and Constitutional Affairs Committee in Government slating the Parliamentary and Health Service Ombudsman for having a distinct lack of ambition in terms of its ability to resolve complaints arising out of the COVID pandemic. Moving on to the main part of this podcast, I'm delighted to welcome back Jim Hirschman to the episode. Jim, say hi to the listeners, tell them who you are and what you do.
Thank you, Matt. My name's Jim Hirschman. I'm a barrister at 3PB Buildings and I specialise in social care law.
Brilliant. And Jim's here today to discuss, as I suggested earlier, two cases coming out of the Court of Protection. Firstly, D and S. The reference is 2023 EWCOP 8. And then after that, A Local Authority and PG, 2023 EWCOP 9. Starting then with DNS, this was a really interesting decision, I thought. Jim, do you want to summarise for the listeners what the key facts were in DNS?
Yeah, so the very broad background is that the court is confronted with two applications, a best interests decision before the Court of Protection and an application for a decree nisi before the family court. Now, the snapshot background in terms of the Court of Protection proceedings is the court needed to determine whether it's in P's best interests to support the application for a decree nisi. So the broad background is that P took an overdose of drugs, which resulted in a very significant brain injury, remained married, there were some assets in the background, and the question for the wife in that circumstance, in part, was whether or not remaining married would protect her financial position. Now, for listeners, the most relevant part is what went on that led to it coming before the Court of Protection. The protracted family proceedings, issues in relation to the deputies. There was a solicitor appointed a deputy. The district judge, with conduct of the family proceedings, took the view that he did not have the ability to conduct divorce proceedings on behalf of P. P's brother then ended up becoming a litigation friend, but was found not to be suitable. The official solicitor declined to act because there was no security for costs, and in the end a friend of P started acting as litigation friend.
Interesting. It sounds like it was quite a long background. Sounds like there was a lot of issues with the litigation friend there, and that's something I know, Jim, you're keen to talk about later on.
Yeah, exactly. The difficulty of finding a suitable litigation friend, I think, is really well illustrated by this case and by the background in it. But it ends up coming before Mr. Justice Hayden, and what he then has to grapple with in this judgment really is the best interests decision. So first of all, capacity, and second of all, is it in the best interests of P to support the decree nisi?
And that's why this decision is so interesting as well, I think. I mean, it's acknowledged in the actual judgment itself that there is a dearth of authority analysing what information might be regarded as relevant to a decision to divorce. And this, I don't know about you, Jim, but this is certainly the first case I've seen that does grapple with it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I mean, there's a tendency in the Court of Protection to always consider what information does P need to understand in order to be able to make a capacious decision. And there is a focus upon lists. And this case is no exception.
I was going to say, I thought this was a bloody good example, Jim, if I'm honest. And there we are.
Yeah, well, it is. And what's said really is Mumby is cited in Sheffield City Council and E 2004 EWHC 2808 and says that in relation to capacity to consent to marriage, you need to understand three things: the broad nature of the marriage contract, the duties and responsibilities that normally attach to marriage, including that there may be financial consequences, and that spouses have a particular status and connection with regard to each other. Third, that the essence of marriage is for two people to live together and love one another.
And they're obviously the crux of the judgment, and we'll come back to those because they are interesting.
They are, and I suppose the last thing just to say on that really is just that whilst Mr. Justice Hayden said he broadly agrees with those criteria, he's, you know, restates that they're not set in stone and need to be tailored to the particular individual in the context of their own circumstances.
Tell us about the King's Proctor, Jim. There'll be plenty of listeners who've probably got no idea what that means.
Yeah, well, the King's, or the Queen's Proctor, as it was referred to. What is said there, basically, is that there needs to be a consideration as to whether or not a referral should be made to the King's Proctor. The issue there is whether or not the intervention should have been ordered under Section 8 of the Matrimonial Clause Act 1973. And that essentially sets out that the court may, if it thinks fit, direct that all necessary papers in the matter be sent to the Queen's Proctor, who shall, under the direction of the Attorney General, instruct counsel to argue before the court any question in relation to the matter which the court considers it necessary or expedient to have been fully argued. That was not front and centre of this case. It was only flagged by Mr. Justice Hayden. But what he basically said, that from the research, there's no reported case relating to intervention predicated on concerns for a protected person that has engaged the Queen's Proctor on how the King's Proctor. But it's relevant because it shows the Mental Capacity Act 2005 and protections that predate that act and the interplay between them perhaps not having been litigated as fully as we expect it to have been in the fullness of time.
Good. So it sounds then like there are four key things for us to discuss today, and we'll come on to talk about what the actual outcome of the judgment was. But is it a fair summary, Jim, for me to say that there are four issues that interest you in particular? So the point around the finding of an appropriate litigation friend, the level of evidence required for these types of applications, what the actual relevant factors were identified as being, and then this point that you raise about the King or Queen's Proctor.
Yeah, that's right, Matt.
Good. Out of interest, what was the outcome of the decision before we get into those issues?
In this case, it was found to be in P's best interests for the divorce to take place. The relationship had broken down. There'd been no contact, really, between the wife and her husband for a considerable period of time. And it was not clear that the marriage in any way protected her position financially.
Interesting.
And in the end, I think she conceded that she would no longer oppose the making of the decree nisi.
Good. So, talk to me a little bit about the suitability of a litigation friend. I mean, obviously, listeners will know of difficulties with the official solicitor. I mean, I think we all are familiar with the fact that you need to have security for costs with the OS involved. Otherwise, it simply won't act. What were the other important issues concerning litigation friends in this decision?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing here is the background. So you have a property and affairs deputy, Mr. Neil Baker. The district judge with conduct of the family proceedings says, well, you don't have capacity to act in the divorce proceedings. So an invitation was then made to the official solicitor. And yeah, security of cost wasn't provided, so that was declined. You then have P's brother acting as a litigation friend. Issues then arise there with the financial complexities and the overlap of interest that different family members had. So a decision is made that within the family court, he was no longer considered a suitable litigation friend. So you end up then with a friend of P's and acting as litigation friend, but a friend who had limited contact with P, perhaps hadn't visited him anywhere near as much as he had hoped. And what that illustrates is the difficulty of where someone loses capacity in some cases of finding someone who can suitably act as a litigation friend. And here a friend was found, but it was essentially the third intervention that it took.
I mean, it's interesting with Mr. going back to Mr. Baker's involvement. So he was the deputy, did you say, for property?
Yes.
Was there any indication given in the judgments about a re-ACC application being made to the court?
No, I didn't see any reference to that.
It's interesting. I mean, I suppose one of the ways that, thinking it out loud slightly, I mean, you may tell me I'm talking rubbish, which would probably be a fair comment, that the deputy could have dealt with it is perhaps applying under the re-ACC criteria to try and get authority to conduct that divorce litigation.
Well, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, what's said at paragraph 3 of the judgment is that District Judge Anson heard the case, concluded that Mr. Baker did not have authority to conduct divorce proceedings on behalf of P. The district judge himself actually invited the official solicitor to act at 4D, and the case that was cited there was Re-W 1971 CH123, which of course was determined prior to the present iteration of the Court of Protection. We all know the official solicitor needs three things: evidence that D lacked capacity to conduct proceedings, that no other person was able to act, and that there was security for costs. But wasn't seen beyond that.
Fair enough. Is it common then in your experience for there to be this volume of litigation friends? I mean, certainly the cases I've seen and been involved with, typically, I suppose as counsel we have the benefit of having solicitors who've arranged this all for us, but typically litigation friends have been involved from the outset. You don't really get too heavily involved in helping appoint the litigation friend, besides perhaps a bit of drafting of orders. Is this commonplace in your experience?
Ideally you want to get a litigation friend at the first time of asking who's able to act within the proceedings. I think generally in most cases that I've acted, that has been the case.
Good. And in terms of the second issue then that you were keen to discuss, Jim,
yes,
this issue around the evidence. Now, I know from my own reading of the judgment that the court was critical of the parties for their lack of, or perceived lack of evidence in relation to the key issue. I mean, what kind of evidence, and I suppose we speak from hindsight and having now read the judgment, what kind of evidence would you envisage needing to be required for that kind of application?
Well, it's paragraph 14 of the judgment that really deals with this, and it's helpful and not unusual for me to come before a court of protection judge who really wants to be able to grapple with P. What is P like? What would P really have wanted in the circumstances? What interests did P have when he or she was capacious? And that's basically what Mr. Justice Hayden says. As I've said, very little of D's character and personality emerged from the papers. Until I heard from F, that was P's friend, I had no sense of D's dynamism, competitiveness, and energy. And I think that really shows what a judge wants to know. If a judge is going to be making a decision on someone's behalf, they want to know what is the essence of the person I'm making the decision on the behalf of. And we can always focus on sort of external interests, best interests, sort of in a vacuum. But judges will want to know, well, what would P have wanted? And I think this case drives that home. eloquently.
Good. Now, the most interesting part of this case, certainly from my perspective, was that it was the first time, or the first recent case that I can think of, that deals with the criteria for capacity to divorce. And you rightly point out the court relied upon the comments from Mr. Justice Mumby, as he then was, in Sheffield City Council and E, about the criteria for the capacity to enter into marriage. Just remind us what those three criteria or four criteria are.
Yeah, so it's the broad nature of the marriage contract. That's the first one. The second are the duties and responsibilities that normally attach to marriage, including that there may be financial consequences and that spouses have a particular status and connection with regard to each other. And third, that the essence of marriage is for two people to live together and to love one another. And plainly, the decree nisi is a step to ending the marriage. And if you need to end it, it follows that the criteria will be similar. You need to know that those three elements are what you are ending.
And what do you? Now I'll come on to my own thoughts in a moment. But what are your thoughts on these three criteria when you apply them to the divorce situation?
I think it's accurate. I think it gives you a good understanding of what P needs to understand. So I'd agree with it. I mean, I think they're a useful starting point. I suppose perhaps I'd add to that some understanding of the financial consequences, not just on the spouses, but also on wider family.
And do you think there's any scope in relation to... I mean, the assumption that I get from this judgment is that the two individuals were married by way of the Christian faith. Do you think there's any scope to change that criteria in marriages of a different faith?
I think you need to consider perhaps the understanding that it might have socially. If, for example, there were evidence that someone being a divorcee is going to have very negative consequences to them, then I think that would be a really important thing to weigh up in the matrix, and you need to have some understanding of that. But certainly I didn't see any evidence of that in this case.
No, and it's an interesting point, though. I mean, you're right. If there's going to be... I mean, there are certain faiths or certain cultural groups where being divorced might be seen differently to those of the Christian faith, and I think you're absolutely right, actually, that must have to be taken into account.
Or even certain really conservative Christian groups.
The one that I... well, there are two, really, that I have issue with. To nail my colours to the mast.
Yep.
I agree, I think, that the duties and responsibilities that attach to a marriage, including that there may be financial consequences and the spousal status, etc., is probably fair enough, because I think that is, certainly to my mind, the crux of what a marriage is. The other two, though, I take some issue with, I think. For the broad nature of the marriage contract, and perhaps you can persuade me otherwise here, actually, I just don't know what that means.
Yeah, well, this is often my issue with lists. I think they merge into one. I mean, the duties and responsibilities that normally attach to marriage, I'd say that is the broad nature of the marriage contract. But I think it's a helpful mental exercise, even if you duplicate the work to some extent, to have these lists and to focus on the different elements, or the different questions, even if they are the same way of asking the same question, or different ways of asking the same question.
I suppose what it does do is leave scope or wiggle room for scenarios where... and just to continue the example from earlier, really, for ease of reference, where there are particular groups where marriage might mean something fundamentally different to how we understand it, it leaves scope for that to be interwoven into the criteria.
Yes, and I suppose that goes to the third point, the essence of marriage being for two people to live together and to love one another. If hypothetically there were other arrangements, if the essence of marriage, for example, was a union of I don't know, financial assets and protecting that, you know, maybe then the third one would need to be tweaked in that situation.
Yeah, I mean, the third one, I wonder how long the third criteria, so that the essence of marriage is for two people to live together and to love one another, how long that will stand a test of time for, because certainly in the, I mean, I'm not a family barrister, but certainly the modern scenarios that you read about or see on the big screen, etc. I mean, there's certainly leeway, I think, for that to be manipulated. I mean, the essence of marriage for two people, well, we see certainly modern day relationships, and you know, we're not here to criticise or draw attention in particular to any one type of relationship, but you do see polygamy on the rise. And certainly I was reading a really interesting article recently about the idea that actually one way to potentially save a marriage if you have sleeping difficulties is to sleep in separate rooms, and potentially own separate accommodation, etc. So the concept of living together could potentially be watered down. I would hope that what wouldn't change is the fact that you need to bear in mind that there should in theory be love in the marriage.
Yes.
But otherwise I think some of the criteria there are traditional values that perhaps need to be tweaked for the modern era.
Yeah. No, I certainly agree with that.
Interesting. Although I suppose, I mean, just completely contradicting myself, that is then, I suppose, why in the judgment it reminds everyone that these are broad principles that need to be tailored to the individual. So, I mean, on balance, I suspect you're right and they are good examples.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's mental exercise for the judge to go through, but I think, as one of my tutors on the bar call said, when you use a precedent, you need to show them a degree of disrespect. And I think the same is true of any list.
Yeah, that is true. What on earth then is the Queen's proctor? This is not a to be completely honest. This is not a concept that I had come across actually until I read this judgment. I don't know if I'm ashamed to say that or not. Like I say, I've never done family law.
Yes.
But you tell us. Well, you I know in a long time ago you did some family law, so you probably have more familiarity with this than certainly I do and some of our listeners.
Yeah, well, I still do a bit of family, but I don't deal with the money side. But if you look at Section 8 of the Matrimonial Causes Act, it says that the court may, if it thinks fit, direct all necessary papers in the matter to be sent to the Queen's proctor, who shall, under the directions of the Attorney General, instruct counsel to argue before the court any question in relation to the matter which the court considers it necessary or expedient to have fully argued.
Perhaps I'm asking you to state the obvious, but what kind of circumstances does the Matrimonial Causes Act envisage that being used for? Does it give an indication?
I can't say that I'm able to answer that, I'm afraid, at this juncture.
That's okay. I mean, you can. Presumably, it's not addressed in the judgment.
Not in detail. I think essentially it's there to protect people abusing the divorce process and to act as a safety net to enable the court to bring in representations to represent the king's interest, if you like. And I think that's the essence of it.
I suppose that. I mean, if we're thinking really laterally here, that may then hark back to this concept of property being vested in the monarchy, etc.
Yeah, and returning to the crown if no one else can claim it.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, what the judgment does make clear is it's never been dealt with in the court of protection context before.
Yeah, it's not been used as a safety net for a protected person, or there's no reported cases on it.
Well, Jim, perhaps the next time we get together, you'll have had the first. That was really interesting. Thank you for that.
Yes.
Shall we move on to a local authority in PG?
Yeah, let's do it.
This is another interesting case. I thought it's the most recent one, I think, or second most recent, to have been issued by the court.
Yes.
Do you want to take us through the facts of this one, Jim?
Yeah, of course. So this is before Mrs. Justice Leven. It concerns PG, who's a 34-year-old woman who has diagnoses of an intellectual disability in the moderate range and autism spectrum disorder. The broad background here was that she was associating with young men, and they were often smoking drugs. This resulted in her, on one occasion, April 2022, becoming semi-unconscious, going out again and then being brought home by a neighbour. There's also situations of her being drinking, possibly taking drugs with young men, then becoming highly confused, and the police or an ambulance having to be called. The primary issue in this case was the differentiation between unwise decisions or decisions made which were not capacious, and fluctuating capacity was the predominant issue with which the court had to grapple.
And for those of you who are familiar with cases concerning fluctuating capacity, we'll be fully aware that this is always a bit of a nightmare. There were four in the court of protection context key issues, weren't there? We won't necessarily discuss each of them in great detail because there are wider issues to discuss, but PG's capacity to conduct proceedings, enter into an occupancy agreement, make decisions about her care, and make decisions about her contact with others. And it arose from her being admitted to hospital under Section 2 of the Mental Health Act, didn't it?
That's right. I mean, it's perhaps helpful to say that the Integrated Care Board had joint funding responsibilities under Section 117 of the Mental Health Act 1983, which followed on from that admission, I think. And the local authority also had care responsibilities.
So in terms of the actual difficulties then that arose in this case from PG's fluctuating capacity, I mean, I got three issues, really. Mm-hmm. So firstly, the plain fact of her fluctuating capacity. As you say, the close correlation between times when she might lack capacity but alternatively could just be making unwise decisions. And then something that seems to be cropping up more and more, and I know it's cropped up in your caseload because we've been discussing it recently, the correlation between making unwise decisions and making decisions whilst intoxicated.
Yeah, yeah, really difficult issue. It's difficult because it's very hard to split cause and effect. You know, is someone making a decision because they, I don't know, are craving alcohol, for example, or are they making the decision because they have rigid thinking, perhaps, that leads them to want to spend lots of times in pubs or drink a certain amount of drinks in a day? It's not clear whether that's a physical addiction or the mental process in action.
And what kind of evidence would you usually expect to see in cases like that?
I think you would probably expect there to be a psychiatrist with expertise in the mental disorder from which P might be suffering. I think you might expect an addiction specialist to give evidence as to how addiction functions and how it works. And I might expect a treating consultant, a hepatologist, for example, to be there to give evidence about the physical consequences that continued drinking may have.
Interesting. Now, there were two approaches that the court considered in this case regarding fluctuating capacity, weren't there? So the two that I identified, so firstly, the approach with reference to Cheshire West and PWK of what the court called a longitudinal approach.
Yes.
I.e. effectively distinguishing between individual instances such as the making of a will or an LPA and cases where decisions had to be taken regularly and often at short notice.
I think that's right. I mean, what that line of authority says, in my view, is that there are some decisions that require you to make regular decisions. And if you can't regularly make those decisions in a capacious way, then you might be found to lack capacity overall.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting case, the Cheshire West one. I mean, the particular point that I thought was interesting is the constant analysis, really, that's required, because, and we'll come back to discuss this in more detail later, because I think it's one of the fundamental difficulties of this approach, in the fact that whoever's assessing P's capacity has to actually assess their capacity at the time of the decision, but the weight of that capacity and how close they are to actually having capacity in relation to the decision that needs to be made seems to me to be a particularly difficult and tricky practical thing that needs to be done.
Really hard, and it's Sir Mark Headley in that case who's referred to, and he himself refers to his judgment in A, B and C and X, Y and Z 2012 EWHC 2400 COP. And one thing he says at paragraph 41 of that judgment is, in light of Dr. Poser's evidence, I am satisfied on balance that he lacks capacity to manage his own affairs. In so finding, I acknowledge, as I have done in relation to the other matters, that there would be times when a snapshot of his condition would reveal an ability to manage his affairs. But the general concept of managing affairs is an ongoing act, and therefore, quite unlike the specific act of making a will or making an enduring power of attorney. The management of affairs relates to a continuous state of affairs whose demands may be unpredictable and may occasionally be urgent. In the context of the evidence that I have, I am not satisfied that he has capacity to manage his affairs.
So that's one approach that was put before the court to consider in this case. The other approach was that comes out of the Wakefield DN judgment, which is in effect where the parties invited the court to make what's referred to as an anticipatory declaration, i.e. a declaration that would bind in future to cover occasions where P has a meltdown.
Yes, and it was Justice Cobb in that case at paragraph 51 where he deals with that. And interestingly, in that party, all parties agreed that he could or should make anticipatory declarations as to DN's capacity to make decisions about residence and or care under sections 15 and 16 of the Mental Capacity Act 2005, to cover, as you said, Matt, occasions when he has meltdowns and is at that point unable to make capacious decisions. But it's interesting, because residence and care, you could say care, for example, is continuing in a similar way of making decisions about your affairs. You might need to decide whether you want one drug or another drug on a particular day to deal with your heightened levels of anxiety. That's the sort of thing that might crop up urgently, to use the words of Sir Headley.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So the court balanced and considered both of these approaches in the PG case, ultimately falling in favour of the approach of the longitudinal approach. The reason being predominantly that making an anticipatory declaration would in practice be unworkable for those caring for PG, and would then relate poorly in relation to how her capacity fluctuates.
I mean, that's right. The interesting thing in that judgment of Mrs. Justice Leavitt is that she also, though, says that I do not think one or the other is the correct or indeed better approach, and she says that at paragraph 36. But she does, as you say, fall in favour of the longitudinal approach on the basis that the anticipatory approach would not be workable in this situation. And she sought to distinguish DN. She says PG does not have capacity in relation to decisions around her care, both when at home and in the community, although when calm, she does at times make capacious decisions within the meaning of section 3.1.
I mean, this to my mind is a great example of something that you see a lot in the COP, and you don't see so much in the community care judicial review world, because it's more of a blunt tool, but of a judge taking a step back, looking at all of the options, and then favouring what is purely the most practical, realistic option, both for those caring for and P themselves.
I think that's right. And I suppose with both these approaches, you sort of end up in the same point. If carers really judge to perfection when someone's so dysregulated that they've perhaps lost capacity, then the interventions will still take place when they need to. But at paragraph 43 of her judgment, taking a longitudinal view that there is no capacity, she still says, well, interventions need to be minimal to protect autonomy, and the working assumption therefore is that they won't intervene a lot of the time because they don't need to. And I suppose that's the thing about the court of protection and judgments. It relates, or relies rather, on carers to make continuing assessments of care and to maximise the autonomy of P by not overstepping the mark of care or overstepping the powers that they might be granted.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I would say, I don't know if I agree necessarily that the anticipatory declaration would be any more difficult necessarily for care staff than what's been ordered. I mean, here the care staff are still effectively having to do the same thing. They are still instant by instant having to determine if P has capacity, and they're also having to go a step further, arguably, in determining how far removed from having capacity P is, in order to then determine how much weight they should place on P's views. At least with an anticipatory declaration, you get a straightforward yes or no decision.
Yes. And I suppose, in part, it's the blanket protection that comes from Section 5 of the Mental Capacity Act as to carers and, reasonably believing that P lacks capacity when they do an act in relation to care. One could say they have greater protection when they have a court declaring that P lacks capacity. And you might argue, as a matter of policy, that will make them less cautious than they might be if there was an anticipatory declaration that required them to take this additional step. So I think some would be able to, with some justification, criticise the blanket declaration as to lack of capacity or finding a lack of capacity. And certainly it's somewhat hard to square it with the idea that someone is presumed to be capacious until found otherwise. With this idea that, well, to make this decision, you will have to be able to make lots of decisions over an extended period of time. And because you can't do that most of the time, we're going to find you lack capacity. It seems to ignore the snapshots where you do make capacious decisions.
Yeah. And the other thing that I find, I mean, I'm not going to talk about it at great length, but one of the questions of the court was whether P had capacity to enter into an occupancy agreement. Now, it may be that that falls under the remit of whether P has capacity in relation to residence, but I'm not sure that issue was actually dealt with in the judgment.
No.
That being said, I suppose it would depend on the actual order that was produced and whether it was included or encompassed by residence.
Yes. No, I think that's right.
Did you have anything else you wanted to say about this one, Jim?
Not on that particular point, but I think one interesting element was about alcohol consumption.
Yes.
And mental impairments. I did want to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, of course.
And it was just really what was said by Mrs. Justice Leven in the conclusion at paragraph 40. And she says it may well be that there are times when her decision-making is impacted by alcohol consumption. However, the evidence is clear that her decision-making is impacted by her mental impairment under Section 2.1 and not simply by consuming excessive alcohol. She goes on to say this at 41. It is not possible to disentangle the influence of alcohol from the impact of her mental impairment. If the evidence was that PG only lacked capacity at times when she is intoxicated, then the position would be different. But that is not the evidence. No party argued that the mental impairment has to be the sole cause for the person being unable to make a decision within the meaning of Section 3.1. And she goes on to conclude that the primary, although quite possibly not only, reason for PG not having capacity in relation to decisions about contact with others is her mental impairment. And that's important, because if you lose capacity because you've just drunk a lot of alcohol, then that's not related to your mental the function of the mind.
Yeah.
It's any capacious individual who drinks a lot may lose capacity at that time, but not in a way that would engage the mental capacity act.
Well, Jim, I'm sure it's safe to say that you, I, and many of our listeners have probably been in that position themselves.
Yeah.
And in the words of Jeremy Clarkson on that bombshell, Jim, thank you ever so much for joining me again today. It's been really good to have you here, and I hope everyone listening has enjoyed learning about these cases as much as Jim and I have enjoyed recording this episode. Thank you ever so much for listening, and we will see you again next time.
Thank you, Matt.